This is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the contemporary art worlds. I hope you guys are not frozen over too badly. I am Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. This is episode 288 with Laura Rakovich. She is a curator, writer, and museum director in New York, formerly director of the Queens Museum, among other institutions. And we talk all about curating, dealing with museum boards, working as a director for a museum, and everything you want to know about that, as well as the changing landscape of museums and the politics around that changing landscape. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can, of course, go to the About page, navigate to the episode index, and find out who's been on the show since back in 2011, all the way back to episode number one. Of course, you can also find our social media, support the show financially, and if you are interested in the Conversations Virtual Cafe, now you can simply hover over the contact link of the menu at the top of the page, and you will see Virtual Cafe appear below that. Click on that, and you can join the mail list for the Virtual Cafe, of which we are doing our ninth tomorrow from the time that I record, so Friday, February 19th. And so if you would like to join in, these are ways that we can congregate as listeners on various prompts and topics, as well as occasionally have special guests. We've had four already, including most recently Robin Kaiser Schatzlein, who was a recent episode, that particular cafe. So check that out if you haven't already. And if you have any people you want to nominate as special guests for that cafe, do reach out. We would love to have your suggestions. Not a lot to say before we jump into this episode. Working on some grants. If anybody knows anything about taking slides, 35 millimeter slides, and converting them into digital images, I probably will have to be dealing with that pretty soon because I have some work going back far enough where I used a camera. And we'll have to deal with that, and hoping my old Epson scanner that is sitting in the closet will do the job. Oh, just really quickly, before we jump in, I almost neglected to remind you that this is a listener-supported show, and if you like this show, if you are a regular listener to this show, we do have ways that you can support us. Financially, you can support us by being an ongoing Patreon of the show on Patreon for as little as a dollar a month, though five or more dollars a month is extremely appreciated. You can also support the show with ongoing PayPal donations or one-time PayPal, Venmo, or old-fashioned check donations. You can reach out to us about any of those methods via theconversationpod.com/support. You can also support us non-financially by leaving us a great review on Apple Podcasts, following us at Artist Podcast on Instagram, or me, Michael Shaw Art, on Instagram. And you can spread the word about the show so more people know about it. Finally, big thanks to those people who are making the show happen: Allison Widows, Lydia Kegler, and Van Cascinero. Thank you very much for all your help. Thank you guys for listening. I hope you're holding up okay, that you're not frozen over. And if you're in Texas, I hope you get through potential blackouts ASAP. Thank you very much for being here, and I will enjoy the episode. I will talk to you again in a couple of weeks. Until then, be well. So, Laura, you're in New York City, and how do you refer to yourself these days? I mean, you've been a museum director. You still are a museum director, if I remember right. Is that sort of your identity, or is it a little more fluid than that?
I mean, it's a lot more fluid than that these days because I'm doing so many different things. So, you know, I sort of refer to myself as a a writer and a curator and a perhaps recovering museum director. I'm not sure. I'm still the interim director of the Leslie Lohman Museum until February 10th. So I guess I'm still currently a museum director, but in a larger kind of cosmic sense, I think I'm a recovering museum director.
A recovering museum director, right. Yeah, it's interesting. One of the things that I wanted to talk to you about is being a curator and being a museum director, because when you take on the role of museum director, there is a lot of administrating involved. And, you know, one would suspect or assume that that tends to take up a lot more time than actual curating. Is that generally fair, or how would you put it?
I guess I would say this. I mean, I'm not a traditional curator in the sense of like, if you think about the root of the word curator, it's from the Latin curare, which means to care for, in the sense of caring for objects. And I've never been that kind of a curator. I think I take the word curator in the cultural context to mean caring for the situation of the museum or the conditions of the cultural encounter. And so for me, it's really about that curatorial work fits in then with what is structural within museums. And so, you know, I think part of my desire within the cultural space is to enact that kind of care. And yes, that involves art and artists and the art that artists produce to also enact that care. And so I'm very interested in a kind of artwork that really connects art and life in a really particular way in order to get to that space. And then there's this other layer, I would say, that I think any museum director engages in, no matter what scale the institution is, which is that, you know, oftentimes the director is involved with decisions about what projects next to each other or amidst one another within the space. And I think that there is a kind of storytelling that can happen there that's really fascinating between projects that may or may not have anything necessarily curatorially to do with one another, but nonetheless speak to one another.
Mm-hmm. But to what extent, though, when you were the museum director at the Queen's Museum, were you, you know, doing board member meetings and, you know,
right.
So that was kind of what I was alluding to.
I mean, being a museum director, you are the chief fundraiser for the museum and the chief administrator, as well as the chief artistic director. And so you have all of those things that have to balance. So yes, of course, I was like knee deep in all of that. The administrative piece took up way more time than the artistic piece, unfortunately. But or fortunately, I think there are spaces in which those are spaces in which we really learn what the limits are of the agency that we might have over these spaces.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about working with the board? Because that was something that was one of your big challenges, right, at your last post at the Queen's Museum. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think a lot has become clear in ways that maybe it wasn't 4 years ago. I mean, you know, we're talking on the Friday of the week that Joe Biden was inaugurated. I started at the Queen's Museum, you know, basically a year before Donald Trump was inaugurated. And obviously the Queen's Museum being the place that it is, its location in Queens, one of the most ethnically, racially, and linguistically diverse places on the planet, a place where many immigrants arrive in the United States and also many stay. You know, this was a place that had, whose people had great fear, you know, throughout the Trump campaign and into the presidency. And that's kind of when I took the helm there. So, you know, I've been thinking a lot about that moment where I was kind of convinced that this was going to be a terrible and very harmful phase of U.S. history that we were walking into. And, you know, I think I wish more people saw it as we did back then, because I think there could have been some work that could have been done to protect the people who are most vulnerable, and we wouldn't. And I don't know. I think that there was a moment that was a moment where we really recognized at the museum, because of how many people, not only in the communities that we've collaborated with and served for so many years before my time, but also, you know, on staff, as recent immigrants were likely to be on staff as they were in our audiences. So, you know, they were a target population of the xenophobia and hate that Trump was advocating for early on. So that was very clear to us because we lived that reality every day.
I was asking about the board. What, you know, can you talk about it from that perspective? Because like I said, that was something you mentioned when we spoke previously.
Yeah. And I think, you know, look, the board of the Queen's Museum was an incredibly, or when I was there, was an incredibly diverse group of people in every way, in terms of life experience, in terms of current job, you know, in terms of history, where they grew up, all of that. And that was very reflective of the institution to a lot of, you know, to a large degree. The issue with boards is that, you know, they have to change with as the institution changes, and they have to, and they have to really see and own the mission of the institution. And I think that at that time, the museum had recently expanded its physical plant, had gone from occupying a very small portion of its current building to the entire building, was going through the growing pains, financial, programmatic, administrative, governance, growing pains that go alongside of that. And, you know, I think that when I started at the museum, you know, I didn't fully appreciate the level of reintroduction to the fundamental activities of the museum that the board would require. And I learned that as I went in that first year, but it was a very short period of time before the urgencies of the Trump administration really pushed us to do some real advocacy work. And that's when I came into conflict with the board, because they, some of them, and we're talking about a handful out of the 25 or more board members that there were at the time. But, you know, as we've seen, very small minorities can, you know, dominate conversations. And so, you know, I think that there was a desire on the part of the staff at the museum, on my part, on the communities we'd worked with, to really be very strong about our support for immigrant communities that surrounded and, you know, made use of the museum. And, you know, the board was a little bit more cautious about that. And so, you know, that's where the conflict brewed.
Mm-hmm. So this handful of people was sort of taking the steam out of a lot of your ideal plans for the neighborhood and accessibility and whatnot? Inclusion.
Well, they, you know, a couple of them just didn't like what I was proposing. You know, I proposed, you know, we created a restatement of values collectively that we, that actually the board overwhelmingly passed, but is no longer on the website, for example, that I think are very important values that we wanted to reiterate given what we saw was coming. You know, we held an event. We closed the museum in solidarity with the art strike on Inauguration Day 4 years ago, and replaced the regular museum activities with a poster making and button making, you know, kind of workshop that attracted over 300 people who were just, some of whom came up to me and just were so grateful that we did something that allowed them to be together on a day that they all felt very vulnerable. You know, and it was everyone from, you know, local immigrant rights activists to grandmas with their who were babysitting their grandkids to, you know, retired school teachers. So, you know, coming from Forest Hills, from Flushing, from Jamaica, you know, it was really an amazing, I mean, it was like your classic Queens hangout. And you know, a couple of the board members didn't really like that we, you know, joined that strike and had that event. Or maybe they just didn't like the optics of it. I don't know actually on a certain level what they didn't like. Some of them just felt that we should be quiet, you know, that we should do what we do, but not speak about it quite so loudly. And what I had understood very early on was that to achieve the goals that we had set out for ourselves in terms of funding this extraordinary institution and bringing it into greater limelight after this big expansion, we needed to increase the visibility. We needed people to understand what we were about and why we did things. And we also needed to talk about the specialness of what we did and how we were different from other institutions. And I think that's where the kind of tension was as well. So, you know, I proposed that we become one of the initial organizations in New York to adopt the art space sanctuary protocols, which were created by Abu Farman, who's and a group of concerned arts people who wanted to you know, let folks know that like cultural space could be a safe space. So, you know, that's where the conflicts really were centered around kind of how vocal to be. And my feeling was and remains that there comes a point where one, you know, you can work quietly and do the thing, but, you know, at a certain point, and I thought the election of Donald Trump was that moment, and I still do, that was the moment to not be quiet about it anymore and to say, you know what, this is what we stand for. And I felt that we owed that to all of the communities who we had engaged over the many years. As I said, long before my time at the museum, we owed it to them to really be clear about our position, you know, in part because we were, you know, people perceive it as a public building, as some kind of state-related enterprise, because the building is in a public park, the building is owned by the city, you know, it has this kind of civic sensibility. And so, you know, and Bill de Blasio, even at the time, you know, did a town hall in Corona and the local high school telling everyone in the neighborhood that, you know, we're all New Yorkers and you can count on the police to protect you from ICE. And, you know, this, all of this kind of rhetoric, because there was so much fear, you know, kids weren't showing up at school, parents weren't leaving their homes, you know, people were really afraid of being caught up in some form of an ICE raid. And, you know, a number of my staff were recipients of DACA documentation. They didn't know what was going to happen to their status. You know, it was like really a nightmare moment.
Yeah.
And we collectively felt that we had to respond. And I thought that was very important. I still do.
So you had, as you sort of outlined, the support of most of the board, but then you had some dissenters. What does it look like just on a voting sense? I mean, was having the majority support kind of technically enough, but because of the loud voices of the minority that was against your optics and your vision and, you know, and your actions, enough to sort of just complicate things to the point where it was unsustainable?
Yeah, I mean, exactly right. You know, being a museum director is a hard enough job. You know, I think Helen Molesworth actually wrote about something last year, this time in Art Forum, about, you know, how boards and staffs are, you know, much further apart than they used to be. There used to be this kind of, you know, closeness, and not all of it for good reasons. I mean, there was a lot of nepotism and all of that, but, you know, and as staffs have diversified, you know, boards and staffs come from slightly different universes than perhaps they used to, and, you know, all of this. But I think that there's this distancing that's happening that makes the translation work that the director has to do between the languages of boards and the languages of staffs and artists. That's quite, you know, a lot. And I think the work of you know, essentially taking a museum that had a $3.5 million budget to like a $6.2 million budget, that takes a certain amount of visibility and putting a stake in the ground for what you stand for. And I felt that that was the right path forward. And it's not that the board members didn't think so. It's just that they wanted it to be slightly different. And so, you know, at a certain point, it just became clear to me that I wasn't going to be able to do the things that I needed to do to make it work. And so that's why I resigned. Mm-hmm. You know, that enough of those people were unhappy with the way that, or maybe enough of the vocal people were unhappy with the way that I was approaching the question that that I felt that I had to resign.
Would you say that this small group, again, to go back to them, are conservative, even Trump supporters?
No, not even. Conservative. I don't even know what that means today. you know, were they Trump supporters? No, not necessarily. They were just had a very different sense of, you know, how one should operate. Some of them had fear about retribution somehow. Some of them were just thought it should be done differently. You know, there were just some basic disagreements about how we should move forward. So, you know, for me, it was a very difficult decision, obviously, because I felt that we had just gotten a Mellon grant for the first time ever. We did this, we made this like amazing proposal that I'm still upset that I didn't get a chance to work on, about reinventing museum interpretation from the bottom up. It was something that I thought would be a really important thing to do, particularly at the Queen's Museum, given the audiences and other, you know, projects. But, you know, it was a really tough decision for me. But I also knew that without the board being like fully, fully behind me, it was going to be a really tough slog, you know?
Right.
So even though we were in this great position, you know, from the outside perspective, internally, it was really difficult. And so I thought, you know what, I'm not doing anyone any favors by sticking around at this point. Let me leave. Let me do something else. And it was really hard. It was a very difficult transition.
Right. Yeah, and you've been writing a lot about museums, both probably before and since, but certainly since. And so a couple examples are The Narrowing of Museum Imagination and Museums Are Never Neutral. And tell me the title of your book that's going to be coming out soon.
The book is called Culture Strike, Art and Museums in an Age of Protest, and it's coming out from Verso. And the pub date is June 15th, 2021. So, my departure from the Queen's Museum prompted me to think more deeply and more broadly about what this idea of the museum being a neutral space means, because this is something that I heard over and over again, you know, well, you know, we have to represent both sides, you know, we have to remain neutral, our funding is based on that of a nonprofit, you can't take sides, blah, blah, blah. And the reality is that the only things that you cannot do as a nonprofit are advocate for a particular candidate in an election, or advocate for a particular piece of legislation. Those are the only two prohibited acts. You know, after the election of Donald Trump, in fact, you know, the Guggenheim, you know, wrote amicus briefs against the Muslim ban. MoMA did a fabulous exhibition of works from the collection that were from artists who now would be banned from entering the country, you know, all as measures of solidarity. So it wasn't as though the Queen's Museum was like wildly out of tune with the moment, particularly with the actions of those much bigger institutions. And, you know, given our special position in, you know, being in an immigrant neighborhood and having immigrants be so much a part of the identity of the institution and who we are, it just seemed to make sense to me. But neutrality was kind of the excuse a lot for like not being, you know, not wanting to do something, not wanting to be a sanctuary, something, you know, anything to a sanctuary. And I thought, wow, this is really interesting. So it's like you can't take sides because you need to be neutral. But like, you know, as we know from Switzerland, neutrality often, you know, supports the status quo. So neutrality isn't really neutral. And I started just diving into that idea and thinking about what that meant and what that meant in the context of these big pushes that have taken place over the last several years of institutions wanting to take on more diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, and yet still kind of holding on to this idea of neutrality. And, you know, I came to the conclusion that, you know, holding on to neutrality as a myth actually prevents a full engagement with that DEI work, as it's called, diversity, equity, and inclusion work. So I thought, well, let me address this through my writing. And I was really fortunate to receive the Emily Tremaine Fellowship for Journalism Fellowship for Curators at Hyperallergic. And so I spent a year writing for Hyperallergic, which is part of, you know, a number of the pieces that I sent to you were from that period to help me really, and it really helped me think through where we are. Where the museum world is in confronting its own biases. So that was really extremely useful, yeah.
And being that you are challenging the status quo, you know, and questioning the system, is that dangerous, for lack of a better word, to your future as a museum staffer, director, or otherwise?
Probably. I am like an eternal optimist. You can't be a museum director if you're a pessimist, because it's just like there's too much that goes wrong on any given day.
Right.
You'd be driven to drink if you were a pessimist.
Right.
So, you know, I felt 4 years ago that there was real leadership work to be done in this space of rejecting neutrality, rejecting the idea that one couldn't make a statement about the state of the world through culture, because at the end of the day, I believe that culture is who we are. You know, it yields a kind of collective zeitgeist and all with all of its warts and bumps and beauty and strangeness. And, you know, and culture can be part, culture and art can be part of how we can see the possibilities that we don't see right now. And I think, you know, there are these all-encompassing kind of universes that feel like we can't get outside of them, you know, like capitalism or, you know, and or even the art world, you know, it feels like how can you possibly get outside of that to, like, you know, do something different? And sometimes it can be overwhelming. And, you know, and I think art actually could provide that lever for us to see the stuff that we're sort of trained not to see by the dominant culture. And that's kind of what I was getting at in the Imagination of the Museum piece. And I was really inspired by Anand Giridharada's book, Winners Take All, because he sort of looks at philanthropy and asks a really potent question about how philanthropy could possibly why would philanthropy possibly dismantle the systems, fully dismantle the systems that created the wealth to begin with? You know, like, it doesn't entirely make sense. And so there's a point at which, you know, a point beyond which philanthropy quite possibly won't go, you know, beyond the argument of, like, why would you ask a, you know, software magnate to, you know, solve malaria in Africa, you know, beyond that kind of questioning. And I think that that is, you know, and that the ways in which philanthropy is funded, that problem solving is funded, also narrows the ways in which we think about what could be done. And he gave this really kind of amazing example of something that happened at the Clinton Global Initiative, where he talks about a panel on, like, women's equity, but the only people on the panel were from the business world. And so they talked about it all within the context of the business world. There wasn't anyone from outside of that. And so in a way, it was like the acceptable kind of lean in, feminism.
Right.
Very white, very upper middle class, like, you know. And it just lacked, it lacked any perspectives outside of that particular demographic that was on the stage, making it like an incredibly anemic presentation. And so I believe that the same thing is happening in museums, where that imagination piece is getting narrower and narrower,
in part because of the corporatization of museums,
in part because of all the pressures they're under to continue to expand and raise more and more money and have boards with more and more billionaires on them and all of that. And so I think the antidote to that, in part, is diversification in like the old school multicultural kind of vibe way. I went to college in the mid 90s, and you know, that was my bread and butter, you know. I believed in multiculturalism, and it kind of went out the window when, you know, with Bill Clinton's like neoliberal, you know, economic miracle. I think that there are a number of us Gen Xers who want to kind of recuperate some of that. And I think my friends and colleague, Jeff Chang, who wrote Who We Be, The Colorization of America, is one of those people. And he's really fabulous. In fact, you should get him on your show. but I think that push towards diversity, towards having a set of very diverse life experiences in the room together, really is what is necessary to change the way that culture works. And I think that change is important, not only because of, you know, for reasons of inclusivity, but I think also that our culture, our bigger culture, our society will be better for it. So I have some very grand desires that come out of my very particular knowledge space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read that Winners Take All as well, and found it also, you know, frustrating and enraging. And I think there are some parallels, you know, despite some of the changes you're talking about with diversity, I think there are some parallels with the art world. You know, when you talk about the museum world, it feels a little bit different, you know, especially when you're talking about an institution like the Queen's Museum, which is, you know, so much more rooted in a neighborhood, you know, and has the the miniature city landscape.
The panorama, yeah, the panorama, yeah. Right, right. Well, and also it's a very different type of museum, right? Because its collection is largely, there's some artworks in its collection that are very important and wonderful, but mostly its collection is the panorama, which is a true treasure, and memorabilia from the World's Fairs that happened in the building that is now the Queen's Museum and on the grounds of Flushing Meadows Corona Park, where it's situated. It's really different from having the Whitney's collection or MoMA's collection. It has a different point of departure. And I think that in and of itself is important, that a museum like the Queen's Museum needs to be able to exist and thrive in ways, because, you know, just like there are people who are going to go to the Queen's Museum and never go to MoMA, there are people who are going to go to MoMA and never go to the Queen's Museum. And that's okay. Not all artistic production needs to be the same or everywhere or whatever. I really love going to MoMA, but there are structural things that are really problematic about the way that it interacts with the world. And, you know, if MoMA suddenly said, oh my gosh, we're going to do this big community engagement, all this community like in Midtown, I would think, okay, that's seriously weird. I don't even know what to say about that.
Right.
I mean, unless they were talking about, you know, doing something with all the deli workers in Midtown.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so you're sort of starting to get to my point, you know, by mentioning MoMA and that activity. But I mean, have you written a little bit about, certainly if you haven't written about it directly, you've certainly thought about it, you know, the insularity of the art world, the pyramidal, hierarchical aspects of it, you know, the wealth, the billion, mm-hmm. the baubles for billionaires, those aspects of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, I think I mean, I wrote the book in Culture Strike. I really look at a couple of different facets of the way that museums function. And I go back historically to look at where museums grew from in the United States, because, you know, those origin stories often tell us a lot about why things are the way they are right now. And the reality of the origin story in the U.S. is that, I mean, obviously there's a lot that comes from Europe, given the colonial nature of the founding of the United States, you know, and, you know, part of that evolution came from basically wealthy men, white men of a certain privileged educational level, kind of getting together in these little clubs. And the earliest museums in the U.S. Were really, you know, kind of societies where people had personal collections of books and drawings and stuff that they liked, and they got together and exchanged it. And then, you know, 50 to 100 years later, some of that became public, and, you know, and then Carnegie came along and made libraries public. That was a really radical move. but, you know, it's still, the museum still came out of the space of the wealthy, privileged white individual collector. And, you know, those people could have collected amazing, gorgeous, beautiful, perfect, like, stuff, but it was still their taste and their desire. And what was left out, it was stuff that they didn't like, they never saw, they never encountered, they thought it just didn't agree with their taste. So, you know, there's a lot to question about how the standards of what is in a museum came to be. And so that's the reason to go back and talk about, you know, that deep history of the evolution of the museum. You know, I think in Europe it was slightly different because these royal collections and church collections eventually became, and you know, kind of no, collections of the nobility became public collections, like the Uffizi, for example. So similar, but not the same, or the Louvre. And there's a great story about the Louvre, which I love, which is when the revolution happened and the Louvre became, went from being a private palace to being, you know, the palace of the people. And then it was open to the public for the first time. And it was so popular among regular people that there were actually prostitutes outside, and they had like trouble regulating the prostitutes because there were so many. On the weekends when everyone went to the Louvre to hang out, which I love.
Yeah,
great, that's story. Great. Let's bring the prostitutes back to the Met.
Right, right. Because we talked about this a little bit on this virtual cafe thing, the sort of live gathering of listeners that we've been doing about the Philip Guston situation.
Uh-huh.
I think I'm going to just choose that one, if that's okay. So
can you
yeah, talk sure. about what your take on that, and this was a situation in which you really kind of felt like everybody was picking sides, but it really seemed pretty nuanced to me, you know, it wasn't clear one way or the other. So I'm curious to hear what your take on it has been.
Yeah, I actually agree with you that there is a lot of nuance here that is really important. And I guess my initial response, because one of my big learnings from, you know, doing the research and my life experience in museums is that we must radically slow down cultural production. Mm-hmm. Right now we're producing too much, too fast. It's just more, more, more instead of deeper and better. And that is really counterproductive, not only to the quality of whatever it is we're producing, but also to the ways in which we engage people in that process. And, you know, I think that's something that's kind of underrated. and yet, you know, circumstances like the one in which Sam Durant found himself in at the Walker, or even the curators of the Biennial, where the Dana Schutz painting of Emmett Till was shown. You know, I think that had more stakeholders and people just even within those organizations had seen and talked about and had access to the ideas that were being kind of put forward through the work, that some of those conversations would have led to either internal, or could have led to internal critique and conversation that might have led to different results. You know, I think about, so with the Philip Guston piece, you know, to me, you know, it's really remarkable that these institutions said, hey, hold on a sec, let's slow down, let's delay, let's really think about this, given where we are at this point in time and what is going on in the streets and the realities of police abuse of people of color, and particularly Black people, and really try to understand how this might be an extremely useful exhibition to kind of help folks deal with the current circumstances. And, you know, I think art can do that. I believe in that. I believe that that art can really interject spaces of reflection and help us to see things we didn't see before. But I do think that there is some really important stuff that Guston has to say to us today, and I'm not upset about revisiting that, especially in the context of his own complicity. And I think that part of what's necessary in terms of in relationship particular to Zena Schutt's depiction of Emmett Till, you know, I think that there was this keen self-awareness on the part of Guston, as far as I can tell, in his work when he was depicting the Klansmen, that he was depicting white men under those hoods. And he was both a Jewish man who would certainly have been highly discriminated against in that period, but also a white man. And so the kind of tension of that complicity, you know, is something that a lot of white people should really be sitting with right now, and trying to understand where they, you know, how they want to live their lives and how they want to kind of unpack that for themselves. So you know, to me, there was this moment of, great, like, these institutions are slowing down, but to what end? And is there censorship going on of the curators? And is there kind of a negation of what all the work that has been already done is, you know, in favor of some kind of tokenistic rehashing? And then, you know, when I heard Kaywin Feldman say that, you know, there wasn't a single person of color on the curatorial team, and that was pretty, that, you know, was a problem, I had to agree with her. So, you know, I think that, yeah, you know, I applaud the willingness to slow the process down. I don't think it needed to take 4 years, and they've revised that now to 2, I think.
Yeah, I think, though, that the point that I want to go back to, or the section of what you were saying that I want to go back to, was talking about something along the lines of sitting with the complicity that, you know, Guston was, that he had.
Portrayed, yeah.
Yeah. The crux of it for me is the choice to not exhibit the work that includes these Klansmen or Klansmen-like imagery at this particular time. That seemed to be what a lot of it was hinging on. That's the way I see it. And I think ultimately to default to safety, you know, especially with the way meme culture has, you know, just skyrocketed in terms of our cultural consumption, makes sense to me ultimately. So for me, it feels like a pretty smart choice ultimately, and that's why I side with what happened ultimately, I guess.
I think it's a pretty challenging thing to make happen inside of a space like the National Gallery of Art or Tate, or, you know, it's a pretty, you know, to ask people, you know, I think cultural institutions need to make those demands of their audiences. And I think that there slowly more willing to. And while I get, you know, I totally take your point, I do think that, you know, I mean, those reckonings are here. You know, I think where, you know, we just saw this attempted insurrection in the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, you know, the white supremacy is an ongoing threat to, well, everyone, but particularly to people of color. And I think that, you know, culture has, if culture can address that and can address it in a way that makes sense and can do it in a smart way, it should.
Right. But my point was that while I appreciate that perspective and the holding, you know, giving the audience a chance, you know, or the opportunity to, you know, or, you know, giving the, instilling in them the respect that they can handle,
right,
is really not the point, because it's the way that the work is going to be, is going to live outside of that sort of very highfalutin context, you know, how it's going to live in memes and out
that's
the world.
Right. I think there are all kinds of images out there. And I think that, you know, as you said, you know, meme culture is a thing that we have to contend with, especially as image producers in the cultural sphere.
Right.
You know, but that can, and those can be powerfully used. You know, I think when I think of, we're launching tonight this amazing new film called Black Magic by Rashad Newsom at Leslie Lohman. That's part of a three-part commission that we did with him. And, you know, it's really about representing Black, queer, joy, resilience, celebration. And, you know, that type of representation is really important. And the way that those images can be, you know, used in Rashad's art, you know, we broadcast those images across Times Square for a month at midnight every night in December. And now there's this film and he's doing a virtual event on February 6th. And I think, like, in this way, you know, he's taking that, the power of that image in this moment, that kind of eye candy, and really working it.
It seems kind of a shame, though, ultimately, that, you know, not necessarily referring to this artist and this work that you're talking about, but with, you know, more complex art, you know, art with a capital A, it doesn't fit with sort of mass promotion or, you know, or virality, you know, in a way that appropriating a Philip Guston hooded figure would, for example, by contrast.
Well, it's interesting because we used... So Helen Molesworth and I planned a sort of town hall, if you will, about Guston, because we both felt very ambivalent about the whole thing. And, you know, I've worked on a number of different projects that were, you know, kind of public fora for discussion. And, you know, I always like to take something that I don't really know what I think about, because I always learn a lot. And so she and I were talking, we were like, oh, let's do this thing. And so we asked a number of people to just contribute some thoughts, and everybody could talk for up to 5 minutes, and whoever showed up could talk for up to 5 minutes until we ran out of time. And, you know, 500 people came, and like over 800 people signed up. You know, and I was like, wow, okay. Wow. I was just sort of flabbergasted by the response, because, you know, neither she nor I are affiliated with an institution. We just kind of put this out there. And I think, okay, so maybe it's because we're in a pandemic and none of us have gotten to dish over the, you know, at an opening about, you know, Guston together. But right. I was really surprised at how many people came out. And, you know, there was a lot of nuance in the conversation. A lot of nuance in that conversation. And my favorite one was, and I think this is a little bit about what we're talking about, which is why I share it. There's this wonderful woman who's on staff at the National Gallery in Washington. anyway, towards the end of the event, she said, you know, we started off and I was kind of thinking there's team snob and there's team woke in this conversation. But now I don't really think that anymore. I think we're all on both of those teams to different degrees.
That's awesome.
And in a way, I love that because it reveals kind of the complexity of the spaces in which we find ourselves these days, where there's quite a lot to negotiate. And it just shows, like, you know, maybe having more public conversations about things that, you know, feel really sensitive is important. It's something else I talk a lot about in my book because, you know, there's this kind of like old school PR response to crisis or to controversy at institutions where, you know, institutions understandably, and this is something I can really, I really identify with because as a former insider, sort of current insider outsider status that I have, you know, I can really identify with the feeling that like you have to protect at all costs because you're so precarious. You're relying on that grant funding. You're relying on that donor. You know, you need to make that transaction happen so that you can continue the work. So you can, you know, pay the health insurance bill that's due next month, all that stuff. That's like the meat and potatoes, I guess, of being running a museum. And yet, you know, might not we all be better if we could maybe pull some of that controversy into the light, you know, or that conversation that invariably is happening behind closed doors or in meeting rooms that's, you know, just the curatorial team or just the PR team or whatever. Couldn't we be better off by having these more public discussions and really laying on the table, you know, what's at stake institutionally? And look, I think a lot of museum directors would hear me say that and think I was bananas because why would you ever do that? But I also think it's a way forward. It's a way to say, look, we actually have a hell of a lot of intelligence in our spaces, not just the curatorial team, but the public programming team, not just the full-time employees, but our part-time educators, our front of house folks, the people who work in the galleries, you know, and, you know, we have ways of problem solving even with public engagement. Mm-hmm. But that would take a different relationship between publics and museums and inside and outside and upstairs and downstairs. But I'm really interested in redoing those relationships.
Mm. Upstairs and downstairs, that's an interesting term to use. You feel like there's a little bit of that actually analogous to the class reference?
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, you know, physically, most offices of museums are on an upper floor, and most of the people who work in the galleries are on a lower floor, like literally upstairs.
Right.
You know, it happens almost at every museum where there's sort of division between the front of house staff and the people who are doing the museum work in the back.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you have this interim director, museum director position that you're doing for a little bit longer, right? And then you will step down and you will have this book come out. So you get to live in that for a period. But are you sort of looking forward, would you say, to, you know, just being, you know, and having this book and not really worrying too much about finding your museum recruiter, your art world recruiter person, or are you? Do you anticipate, even if you don't, you feel like you can worry about that later, that when you do get to that certain point, you will start to get some anxiety around finding a job?
Well, you know, I'm working on a number of different projects right now, which will come to fruition over the next year or so. So I have plenty on my plate, and I kind of promised myself that I wouldn't take a permanent museum gig until after the book comes out at the very earliest, because I want to devote some time to really, you know, sharing the ideas in the book with other folks. And, you know, I think to me, that's the priority right now. You know, I'm working on a project with the Brooklyn Public Library called the Art and Society Census, which is a way of rethinking the way that, or a way of inviting a public conversation about what is collectively desired from cultural space. because at a certain point in my discussion about how financing museums happens, I realized that in working on that and researching it, I realized that in order to balance in the United States the private philanthropy, whether it's from foundations or individuals that comes to museums, one has to have robust public funding, and we can't have that unless we have some kind of dialogue, discourse in the United States about what culture means. You know, and so as I was talking with my colleagues, Jakob Orsos and Cora Fisher at the Brooklyn Public Library, we sort of thought, well, let's ask the public what they think. And so over the last year and a half, we've worked with a number of different advisory groups and amazing people to kind of craft this census, which was launched just before Christmas, and we already have like 1,500 responses. But the city has gotten behind it, and Gonzalo Casals, who's the cultural affairs commissioner here, you know, he's helping us to distribute it now. And so we'll be taking back the data from and the answers from this survey, which you can find on the Brooklyn Public Library website. Which we hope will go to lots of regular folks, not just art world people, which is why I wanted to work with the library on this project, because we thought we'd use the branches to kind of distribute it to people who might not go to museums regularly. And so what we're going to do is take the responses back, understand, you know, what the areas of cultural production are and what parts of museum, you know, function or in cultural function really draw the most commentary or questions or, you know, criticism or ideas, and create some working groups that will be pulled together in the late winter, early spring, to meet for about a month, every week for about a month, to kind of come up with some, and people will be paid to participate in that, and to come up with some recommendations or thoughts about how to move forward in those areas in ways that are more in keeping with public desires. And then once that work is done, we will culminate the census in June at a public event that will invite those representatives from each of those working groups to make public presentations, the timing of which is important because by the end of June or the beginning of July, New York City will have a new city council, two-thirds of which are entirely new to their positions. And probably we will know who our next mayor is because the primaries will have taken place. So this information can be seen as a way to convey to the policymakers, the people in charge of the city, what residents of this city desire. So that's sort of my hope for that project. So that kind of coincides with the launch of the book, which will be great.
Well, that's great to have projects you're passionate about, you know, to keep you busy. But to get back to my question, I feel like the subtext of your answer to me implied that you feel like you have enough cultural capital to, when you're ready, snatch up a job pretty easily. Is that fair?
I don't know. I guess the reason that I would like to wait until after my book is out is that I really believe in the things that are in the book, and I would like to go back into cultural space if there's a board who wants me to do that with that particular institution. Do you know what I mean? I guess my feeling is, I mean, my personal mission, my desire to make cultural space better for more people comes out of that book, comes out of the thinking I've done over the last 2.5 years and longer, obviously, but, you know, quite devotedly the last 2 years. And, you know, I'd want to be considered for positions in light of those ideas and because of those ideas, rather than kind of in spite of it, or like, I kind of know what she's into, but I'm not sure, you know,
right.
Because I think that would be useful. That would put my skills to good work, and, you know, and maybe we could do something extraordinary. But I also know that might not happen, you know, so I'm not, mm. I'm not, I really love being inside museums. I love working with colleagues, and, you know, museums are such inherently collaborative projects. You know, one of my great complaints is how institutions are seen as these like monolithic, you know, kind of abstract spaces, but they're really just like dozens of people trying to get shit done every day. Sure. And, you know, and the power of that and the potential power of that once you kind of own it, you know, own it as a collective enterprise. So I guess my answer is a little bit mushy for you, but I'm going to stick to it.
Right, right. Well, no, I think that that's well said. And I think it sounds to me like you have now a, 275-page cover letter for your next job, basically, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's we'll see. I don't know. Am I permanently out on the outside or am I headed back in? Who knows? We'll see.
Right. Well, from the things you've described, it doesn't feel like you're too much on the outside, although maybe you're living in a slightly tangential world at the moment.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's very, I have to say, like, you know, taking on this very kind of challenging role of being interim director of an amazing and small and beautiful and important collecting museum during the pandemic was incredibly challenging, but it was really rewarding in the way that, you know, we struggled through a lot together. And there's something about that that is highly, it's a beautiful thing, you know, and we made a lot of great culture happen and preserved an institution, you know. So there's a lot of, I have a lot of gratitude for those kinds of experiences.
That's great.
Even though they're really tough, you know, even though they're tough.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great place to wrap up. Thank you very much for talking to me.
Oh, good. It is my pleasure, Michael. I really appreciate the opportunity, and it was a lot of fun.
Great. And we're out.